Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How long does it take to ride through the entire Grand Canyon on the Colorado River? If you sign up for a guided excursion, you might cover the 277 miles over the course of 2 weeks or even three, in part because of the dam that has tamed the river since it was built in the 1960s. But for a brief moment in 1983, a sort of perfect storm of massive snowmelt, heavy spring rains, and an emergency release of water to prevent the dam's failure made the Colorado wild again for a short time. And that is when three river guides, under cover of darkness, climbed into a wooden dory in hopes of navigating the entire canyon, now raging with whitewater, in record time. Journalist Kevin Fidarko is here to tell us about that now legendary trip. He's a former staff writer for Time magazine, who now writes for magazines including Esquire and Outside. He was in town over the weekend for the Mayborn Conference and joins us now to talk about his new book, The Emerald Mile, the epic story of the fastest ride in history through the heart of the Grand Canyon. Kevin, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. I'm so glad to be here.
So talk about, I guess this is the sort of story that, even without a nice full-length book, is passed on from river guide to river guide.
It is. I mean, if you take a river trip through the bottom of the Grand Canyon, whether it's a commercial river trip or whether you're rowing your own boat, what people tend to do is they row whitewater during the day, and then at night they sit around after having dinner on the beaches of the canyon where they're camped, and if it's late spring or early fall, there's a campfire, and they tell stories to one another. And this is one of the great stories of the Grand Canyon. It's part of kind of a fabric of oral history that sort of weaves itself into the experience of the canyon. It's almost impossible, really, to take a river trip down there and not hear the story of 1983, the greatest runoff ever to descend on the canyon in modern times, and the adventures and misadventures that befell the people who were lucky enough to witness that firsthand.
So many times as a journalist, when you take a legendary story and decide to tell it, you end up disappointed because it a lot of its mythology. It sounds like this one is every bit as exciting and more than what you had heard around the campfire.
Yeah, I mean, there were larger-than-life elements to the story itself, which I think is really what drew me to it. Starting with the setting, really, because, you know, we're talking about a narrative that unfolds at the bottom of what is really the single most iconic piece of landscape we have in the United States. I mean, it's almost impossible to find someone who has not heard of the Grand Canyon. It's almost impossible to find someone who would not recognize an image of the Grand Canyon. Mm. I mean, even school children, everybody knows the Grand Canyon. But the thing about the canyon is that there's a kind of ubiquitous awareness that everybody has about it, but most people only experience it in a particular way. Like every year, there are somewhere around 4.5 million tourists who drive up to the south rim of the Grand Canyon. They park their cars in the parking lot. They go over to the edge, and they look into this giant thing. And they spend about 20 minutes on average doing that. And then they go off to the bookshop, and then they go away. Mm-hmm. But there is a... there's a whole world beneath that rim. In fact, I mean, we call it the world beneath the rim, those of us who work and live and develop a deep connection to this place. And that world is largely hidden from the view of anyone who's looking in from above. You can barely even see the river itself, the thing that carved the canyon. And so to come to an understanding of and develop a connection with that world, that secret and hidden world at the bottom, there's really only one way that you can do it, and that is to ride the river, the Colorado River that was responsible for carving, creating the canyon itself, and now provides really the only throughway, the only highway to travel the entire length of the canyon. You can hike in, of course, but most of the trails that lead into the Grand Canyon lead from the rim itself down to the river and back. It's almost impossible to even walk along the length of the river by virtue of the topographic challenges and extremities that you encounter down there. So the river itself is this kind of ribbon that winds its way through the bottom of the canyon and connects everything. And that for me, I think, was the starting point, the realization that the context of and the backdrop against which the narrative events of this story flowed and unfolded was itself epic and worthy of is itself an extraordinary story. So I think that's what really drew me initially into the whole thing.
Why isn't every large and major river surrounded by something as majestic as the Grand Canyon? Can you talk about the geography and the geology, actually, that made the canyon possible?
Yeah, what a great question. And it took me so long to kind of understand this. Because it's sort of what you need to do, and it's hard to kind of do this without spending a lot of time. Geology is something that that is very difficult to kind of absorb at an abstract level. But the short answer to the question is that the Colorado River flows over a feature known as the Colorado Plateau, which is a huge, massive landscape that encompasses four states in the American Southwest: Utah, Arizona, parts of New Mexico, and a big chunk of Colorado. And if you think of this as a giant dome of rock that rose up over a large period of time, and you imagine that prior to the process of that dome rising, there was a river that flew across that landscape. Well, the land itself rose slowly enough that the river, instead of diverting its path and flowing in a different direction, began cutting down into this landmass. And one of the great historical figures in the Grand Canyon, a man named John Wesley Powell, who was responsible for leading the first exploratory trip through the Colorado River, discovering the bottom of the Grand Canyon in the summer of 1869, Powell described this process as a log rising upward into a buzzsaw. And that's kind of a great metaphor, because that gives you a sense of how the river began cutting into the land. And of course, once that process started, once the river had begun incising a path for itself, it could no longer escape. And so over millions and millions of years, somewhere between 6 and 20 million years as we now understand it, the canyon became deeper, the river became more inextricably entrenched, and the material that once occupied the space that we now understand as the Grand Canyon was freighted downstream, truckload by truckload, trainload by trainload, carried downstream and deposited really in the Sea of Cortez in Mexico. So that's the reason why we don't have giant river canyons all over the world. And this is one of the things, one of several things that makes the Colorado River itself utterly unique. There's no other river in the world that has carved canyons like the Colorado River.
So you mentioned John Wesley Powell, and we get his story as a sort of bonus along with this book. I love that you mentioned that the Grand Canyon was essentially the first great land feature of what is now the United States to be discovered by Europeans, we should always add, but the last to be explored. Explain what took so long and why it was Powell, of all people, that made this happen.
So in the autumn of 1540, one of the great expeditions out of Mexico, led by a conquistador, penetrated into the deserts of the Southwest. Coronado was the name of the leader of that expedition. One of his captains, a gentleman by the name of Lopez Garcia de Cardenas, was instructed to lead a party of men off on a side exploration, and in the hopes of connecting with a river that was rumored to cut through the region. And sometime in October of that year, Cardenas and his men, led by a group of Hopi guides, stumbled upon a point where the land itself gave way to what must have felt to those men like something like an inland ocean of air opening up in front of them. And this thing in front of them, it dwarfed by several orders of magnitude any landscape feature that they were familiar with as Europeans. There's nothing in Europe that begins to even approximate the magnitude of that canyon. You could take the entire range of the Pyrenees and drop it into the Grand Canyon, and not one of those peaks would peak above the rim itself. The thing about it is, however, and those of your listeners who are, you know, familiar with that part of the Southwest will understand that it's an exceptionally inhospitable landscape. It's deeply incised, as we've talked about, by a whole set of tributaries of the Colorado, which have cut a whole maze of canyons. It's almost impossible to get across. And so even though this was the first great landscape feature to be discovered in the autumn of 1540, and remember, we're talking several decades before the first settlers landed at Jamestown, and even longer before the first pyramids sighted the sand cliffs of Cape Cod from the deck of the Mayflower. So despite the fact that this event occurred very, very, very early on in terms of the history of the European encounter with what is now the United States of America, several hundred years were to pass before anybody was able to really penetrate into and undertake the enormous challenge of trying to systematically survey, map, and understand this piece of landscape. And so by the time we arrived at the Civil War in 1860, the Colorado Plateau, this area that I spoke about a few moments ago, was really the last great unexplored feature within what's now the lower 48. It was literally the last blank spot on the map. In a map that was actually drawn up by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in 1853, they actually wrote on it unexplored. And so that brings us to a one-armed Civil War major, a gentleman who was a commander of artillery who actually lost the upper part of his right arm during the first several hours of the Battle of Shiloh to a Confederate mini-ball, and who, after recovering from the surgery and amputation that followed, several years later decided to lead a party of men that included nine men in four wooden boats down a river that had a name at the time, the Colorado, whose source and upper reaches were largely known, whose exit and conclusion was also known at the Sea of Cortez, but whose pathway and whose features were a source of deep and abiding mystery. And that effort to launch those boats down this unknown river and penetrate not just through the Grand Canyon but through a series of canyons along the upper Colorado River before reaching the Grand Canyon was one of the greatest feats of exploration that we have in the story of American exploration. And Powell's successful completion of that voyage about 99 days later, when six men, including himself, in two boats emerged from the Grand Wash Cliffs, which is the set of cliffs that forms the exit of the canyon. The moment that they emerged from that really closed a chapter on the history of American exploration that had begun with Lewis and Clark and ended with John Wesley Powell.
My guest is journalist Kevin Fidarko. He's a former staff writer for Time magazine who now writes for publications including Esquire and Outside. His new book is called The Emerald Mile, the epic story of the fastest ride in history through the heart of the Grand Canyon. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Kevin Fidarko. His new book is called The Emerald Mile, the epic story of the fastest ride in history through the heart of the Grand Canyon. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think at kera.org. So, Kevin, the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon that Powell and his party took was quite a different experience from the one that anyone who has been on a river ride through the canyon might recall, not simply because it was uncharted at the time. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. And, you know, I guess it's maybe this is the moment where I should say, too, that, I mean, this was one of a whole list of things that I was completely ignorant of when I began my own kind of exploration with and of the canyon. I mean, when I started as an apprentice river guide, which was in 2003, I mean, I had no idea that, you know, the canyon itself is this kind of 277-mile stretch of river. It starts at this place called Lee's Ferry, which is where all river expeditions begin because it's where the cliffs descend right down to the river level. And it ends at the Grand Wash Cliffs, this place that I mentioned earlier in our conversation. So you've got this 277-mile stretch of river and canyon that is, you know, viewed as being synonymous with kind of wild nature and a place that is isolated and cut off from the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. What I didn't know, however, was that that stretch of what we think of as wild nature is buttressed by and bookended between two of the largest machines that we have ever built. An enormous hydroelectric dam known as Hoover, which is down at the bottom of the canyon and which has created an enormous reservoir known as Lake Mead. So that's all on the western end of the canyon. And then up at the head of the canyon itself, on the eastern end of the canyon, you have the second machine, which is the Glen Canyon Dam, and the reservoir that backs up behind it, Lake Powell. And so these are two enormous hydroelectric machines which were built and designed to be part of a whole set of dams that were designed to take what was the wildest river in the West, a river that was literally uncontrollable. It was, you know, every year would indulge in exceptionally violent flooding because it's driven by snowmelt coming out of the Rocky Mountains, which means that, you know, all that snow tends to kind of melt rather suddenly.
Over a week or two.
And so the water would come sort of raging out of the Southern Rockies and across the Colorado Piedmont and come boring down into the badlands of southeastern Utah and fire hosing through these canyons. And by the time it got to the Southern Colorado River Basin, which is part of an area that's now the richest agricultural breadbasket that we have in the United States, the Imperial Valley, these floods were enormously destructive. And so the dams that were built were designed to take the power and energy of this wild river, harness it, and bend it to the needs of human beings. And one of the things that that means is that if you're thinking about the Grand Canyon, you have to kind of it's helpful to expand the parameters that kind of frame your thinking of this place. If you expand them to include these two giant hydroelectric dams on either end, what you begin to understand at a certain point is that this is a river that sort of embraces and embodies two aspects of American character and American history, right? Because one is, I mean, we're nothing if not a people who defined ourselves and in many ways continue to define ourselves in terms of our extended encounter over a period of approximately 250 years with raw wilderness, right? This is something that is a deep part of who we are as Americans. But an equally profound part of who we are has to do with science and technology and our willingness and ability to take raw nature and bring it under control, often very, very ruthlessly. And the Grand Canyon itself actually offers a kind of metaphor for understanding those two aspects of American culture and American history in a way that I think is very, very compelling and powerful. Not the least because those two aspects of the canyon contain two different subcultures. You have at both of those dams a group of people, most of whom are engineers, who are responsible for maintaining and managing these two hydroelectric structures. And then in between, you have this very kind of fractious and cantankerous community of river guides who are all about basically living and moving on whitewater during the summertime. And these are two subcultures whose values and ideals are in many ways fundamentally opposed to one another. And so this was another aspect of the story that's at the heart of this book that was so compelling for me, the manner in which the journey of this little wooden dory threaded together and provided a piece of connective tissue between these two subcultures that represented two different aspects of America's story, really.
All right, so let's talk about the wooden dory. That is actually the craft called the Emerald Mile, which had a history before it was even brought into use in 1983.
It was such a special little boat, and there's no other boat that I know of in the canyon that has a story like this. So I mentioned earlier that John Wesley Powell led an expedition that consisted of four wooden boats in the summer of 1869. Those boats were round-bottomed boats with keels. They were a type of craft known as a Whitehall. And although Powell didn't understand at the time, they were exceptionally poorly suited for handling whitewater. Mm-hmm. And so during the years that intervened between the conclusion of Powell's voyage and the summer of 1983, another type of boat came to be adopted by, in particular, one of the commercial outfitters that runs trips through the Grand Canyon. And this boat is known as a dory. It's a boat that may or may not be familiar to your listeners, but the story of dories really goes back to the coast of New England, where these boats were invented during the latter part of the 18th century and were used throughout the 19th century off the Grand Banks of Newfoundland in the New England cod fishery. They then undertook a very long journey across the United States, were adopted on two very beautiful rivers in Oregon, the Mackenzie and the Rogue, where they became fishing vessels. And then they made their way down into the Grand Canyon in the hands of a man named Martin Litton, who was a very prominent conservationist and deeply involved in the Grand Canyon, and decided in the early 1960s that if you modified these dories that were being used up in the Pacific Northwest in certain significant ways, they might be able to handle the massive hydraulics and the savage whitewater that prevailed down inside of the canyon. And so he proceeded to build what turned out to be a fleet of wooden dories. And it was a gorgeous and unique thing. Each of these boats, by virtue of his philosophy of conservation, he had some very strong opinions about environmentalism. And he developed a tradition of bestowing on each of these boats the name of a natural wonder that had been destroyed by the hand of man. And early on, he and his boatwright, a gentleman up in Oregon by the name of Jerry Briggs, began experimenting with these boats and modifying them through a series of experiments in an effort to sort of arrive at a design that would perform well in the Grand Canyon. And in the summer of 1973, Jerry Briggs nailed it. He rolled out of his boat shop a little wooden dory that had red gunnels and barrel green paint along the hull. And she was given the name of a stretch of towering redwood trees in Northern California that a logging company during the late 1960s had logged a portion of with the intention of rendering that grove of tall trees inadmissible for inclusion in a national park or monument. And Litton was so outraged by this that he decided to name this story after that stretch of trees, which was called the Emerald Mile. And when he put the boat into the river that summer, he realized that everything about her worked. There was just a sort of a something about her combination of, you know, the length and the beam of the boat and the rocker, which is the curvature of the bottom of the boat and the position of the oars, and it all kind of just fit perfectly. And so the Emerald Mile became the matriarch of the fleet that Litton and Jerry Briggs built together. At that point, Litton's instructions to Briggs were simply, I just want clones. Just copy the boats and start turning them out of your warehouse. And so this collection of boats came out of Jerry Briggs's warehouse, and they were all painted in the same configuration of colors, beryl green, white, and bright red. And each one had a different name of a natural wonder that had been destroyed. And they were like a floating collection of Easter eggs when you saw them on the river. And the Emerald Mile was kind of the most special boat of all, but roll the tape forward 3 years, and something terrible happened to the Emerald Mile. A novice river guide by the name of Stevie Dalton was attempting to take her through one of the biggest rapids at the bottom of the canyon, a place called Lava Falls, which all river guides fear, mm-hmm. with very good reason. And Stevie Dalton missed his entry at the top of this rapid by several feet, which is a mistake you cannot make in Lava Falls, and found himself catapulted into a feature called the Corner Pocket, which is a very, very vicious eddy on the far right side of the river, whose signature attribute is that it kind of acts as a washing machine. And it just sends, if you're unlucky enough to wind up in the Corner Pocket, you and your boat will revolve around and around the Corner Pocket, and each time you make a revolution, you will be bashed up against the side of this giant avocado-shaped chunk of basalt known as the Big Black Rock. And in the course of about 25 minutes, the Emerald Mile was virtually destroyed. She was so badly battered that she barely resembled a boat. They had to lift her out of the water and put her on shore. And when they finished with the duct tape and the baling wire and the pieces of driftwood that they caged from the shoreline, what they had was little more than a floating piece of river trash. And the goal at that point was to just nurse her down the canyon and get her out. Get her to the bottom of the canyon, load her up onto Big Blue, which was Martin Litton's rig truck, drive back to Hurricane, Utah, which is where the boathouse was located. And along the way, that particular crew came up with the idea that the Emerald Mile was not worth restoring. What they needed to do was give her a Viking funeral. And that was going to involve backing Big Blue up to the municipal garbage dump in Hurricane, climbing on top of the truck, lighting the Emerald Mile on fire, and then pushing her off the back of the truck.
But we all know that didn't happen.
It didn't happen because that was the moment when one of the central characters in this story, a gentleman by the name of Kenton Grua, stepped in, put his hands on his hips, and said, no, that's not going to happen. What's going to happen instead is I'm going to take this little boat, and I'm going to rebuild her, basically from scratch, and I'm going to make her my own. And in the process, I'm going to experiment with her and incorporate some features that have never before been seen in a river dory at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, including, for example, false footwells that would enable the boat to be self-bailing, or two sets of oarlocks, which meant, in theory, you could have two people row her at the same time, like a racing shell. And so Grua did that. And that meant that by 1983... he was in an unusual position. He had his own boat. It had some extraordinary capabilities, and he was well aware that if the right set of conditions unfolded on the river, he could do something really extraordinary with her.
So how did he decide who he wanted to go along?
Well, he had two friends, and they both had different skill sets that I think Grua felt complemented his own. The first of these men was a man by the name of Rudi Petschik, who came from a family of Jewish refugees that had fled Europe. They were bankers in Prague, and they had fled Europe just before the Nazis invaded Czechoslovakia. And Rudy's branch of the family made their way to Argentina, where Rudi grew up and learned how to row small boats in an area called the Bariloche. He then headed north and wound up in Berkeley, where he became a scientist and earned his PhD. He then made the mistake of deciding to take a river trip on the Grand Canyon, where he experienced what happens to a lot of people, including myself, which is he fell in love so incorrigibly with the river and the canyon that he decided to basically throw his career straight out the window and devote himself to the science and the art of learning to row wooden boats for Martin Litton. Mm. And because he was an engineer, he was very, very meticulous. And among other things, he was particularly good at calculating water speed and route planning. And so for this idea that Grua had, Petschik was really the first person, the ideal person for figuring out when they should launch and how they should time the journey. Second person was a man named Steve Reynolds, who everybody called Wren, R-E-N, like the bird. And Wren's signature attribute, really, was that he simply had a ferocity and a focus to him that he was able to apply and bring to bear on rowing huge whitewater that was unlike almost anybody else. It was said in the canyon that he got this look on his face at the top of a rapid that made him look like a gunslinger in the Old West. It was almost, one of the people I interviewed said he was almost psychotic, which I think was probably an overstatement. But what it meant was that Steve Reynolds was able to row whitewater so well that he racked up probably more what are called golden trips through the canyon, which is what happens when you row the entire canyon without hitting or dinging a single rock. And he racked up more than those than anybody else.
We are speaking with journalist Kevin Fidarko about his new book, The Emerald Mile, the epic story of the fastest ride in history through the heart of the Grand Canyon. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Kevin Fidarko. We're talking about his book, The Emerald Mile, the epic story of the fastest ride in history through the heart of the Grand Canyon. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Okay, so 1983, as we mentioned in the introduction, was sort of the perfect storm. How much faster was the river moving? How much? I love the phrase fire hosing through the canyon. How was the pressure different than it would have been in, say, spring of 1982, summer of 1982?
Well, good question. And to answer that, we need to sort of understand what was happening meteorologically. So 1983, really unusual year in the history of meteorology. I mean, if you talk to weather experts, they will tell you that what we saw in 1983 was, at the time, the largest El Niño event that we'd ever seen on record, a series of meteorological anomalies that were triggered on the far end of the western Pacific Ocean, took several months to make their way east, slammed into the west coast of the United States, starting right around Christmas and New Year's of that year in a series of what were called superstorms, huge torrential storms that inundated much of the west coast with rain and then started laying down a very, very significant snowpack, a snowpack of historic dimensions in the California Sierra, and a very, very large proportions in the Southern Rockies. Not the largest snowpack we've ever seen in the Southern Rockies, but what made it really unusual and what led to the events that ultimately drive this particular story is the fact that right around May 28th of that year, the temperatures shot into the high 80s. And so you have all of this snow melting all at once and coming out of the Southern Rockies in a huge, fast, wet rush, completely inundating the upper Colorado River basin. Every single tributary of that river is overflowing its banks, and all of that water is hurtling downstream in the direction of Lake Powell, this reservoir that we talked about a little bit earlier, this huge reservoir that contains 9 trillion gallons of water. Held in place by the Glen Canyon Dam. And the men who were in charge of managing the Glen Canyon Dam, they really had no idea how much water was coming out of the Rockies toward them and how fast it was moving. And by the time they figured it out, basically, they were capable of releasing through the dam itself and around the dam about half of the amount of water, or water at a rate of about half of what the water was arriving to the top of the lake at. And so what happened in at the tail end of May and early in June is that the surface of Lake Powell began clawing its way up the face of the dam toward the parapet. The engineers at the dam then turn to their insurance policy, which are two enormous spillway tunnels bored into the Navajo sandstone cliffs on either side of the dam, 40 feet in diameter, three times the size of the London Underground.
So that's a 40-foot fire hose.
It's a 40-foot fire hose. Those two tunnels combined are capable of inhaling 200,000 cubic feet of water per second, which is basically more, it's enough to handle whatever the Colorado River could throw at the Glen Canyon Dam short of a 300-year flood, except in the summer of 1983, the Bureau of Reclamation had never had the opportunity to take those two tunnels for a full-on test drive under flood conditions. The water inside the tunnels began cavitating. This is a complex hydrologic process, which
cavitating, I'm sorry, explain that.
Cavitating is it's basically turbulence set up within the water column inside of these tunnels. And the turbulence was so violent that the water inside the tunnels began boring into the concrete lining of the tunnels. So now this is concrete it's 3 feet thick, and it's reinforced with steel rebar. And during the first week in June, the managers of the dam observed that the water spewing out of the spillway tunnels at the base of the dam, which normally they spew out in a huge arc, what we call a plume, and the water in that plume is supposed to be either white or green. And they observed that, first of all, the water itself was laden with chunks of jagged chunks of concrete and what appeared to be boulders, and also pieces of steel rebar. But what really kind of chilled them to the bone was the color of the water, because it had switched from white and green to basically tangerine, which was the color of the Navajo sandstone on either side of the cliffs on either side of the dam. And so what was taking place was the water inside these spillway tunnels had bored through the concrete lining designed to protect the tunnels. It was now excavating the sandstone cliffs on either side of the dam, creating the question in the minds of everyone as to whether the abutments that are responsible for anchoring the dam itself, the integrity of those abutments might be compromised. And this was a crisis that had no precedent in the history of American hydroelectric engineering. The story of how those men confronted that crisis and solved that crisis is a big part of the book. But in the process of dealing with it, what they ended up doing was sending an enormous amount of water inside the Grand Canyon and creating essentially an artificial flood. To give you an idea of how much water was headed down there, and this gets to your question, in the 17 years prior to 1983, if you were a river guide in the Grand Canyon, you would rarely experience a Colorado River that was flowing anywhere other than 30,000 cubic feet per second. The level tended to vary between about 16,000 cubic feet per second and 30,000 cubic feet per second. Starting in the middle of June, the engineers at the dam began sending what ultimately became 93,000 cubic feet of water per second into the Grand Canyon. It was moving at about 8 miles an hour. It washed out a lot of the rapids, but at a few very, very significant points, choke points really, things went completely haywire. And these were the conditions which both, which sobered everyone on the river, terrified most of the boatmen who were in the canyon already attempting to navigate safely commercial expeditions. But these were also the conditions that electrified Kent and Grua and the two companions he had selected for a speed run at the helm of the Emerald Mile.
So they did this under cover of darkness. They're really not supposed to be out there. And there's a point at which there are park rangers stationed that are supposed to stop anyone trying to get through because the conditions are considered unsurvivable.
They are, and this is another big part of the story. I mean, you have to sort of put yourself into the mind of these Three River guides to appreciate what they were trying to do. They had applied for a permit from the National Park Service. And they explained to the Park Service, you know, that what they wanted to do was they wanted to use this artificial flood created by the crisis at the Glen Canyon Dam, which itself is a product of this historic runoff. They wanted to use the flood as kind of a hydraulic slingshot. And the idea was that it would, if they put on at the crest of this flood, put this little dory into the river, the flood would catapult them through the Grand Canyon. And spit them almost like a wet watermelon seed, just straight through the Grand Canyon. And when they got done, if they rowed fast enough and somehow kept the boat upright and intact, what they do, they would not just simply break the speed record for the fastest boat ever to go through the canyon. They would smash that record so decisively that no one else would ever be able to break it again. And this, in their minds, was a unique opportunity. It was the chance to take this river that had once been the wildest river of the West, that had been brought under total human control, straitjacketed by all of these giant hydroelectric dams. And now, by virtue of the El Nino events of 1983, was experiencing a brief window in which the clock was literally being turned back. For this brief window in time, they would have the chance to participate in and experience the ancestral Colorado River that flowed through the dreams of John Wesley Powell, and do something that nobody else had ever done, and likely no one else would ever be able to do again. So this was what really motivated them, and it's the reason why when the National Park Service told them that under no conditions would they be granted a permit to do this.
It's like a suicide wish, if you look at it on paper. Am I right?
It kind of is. I mean, I don't think they thought of it as a suicide mission. They were confident in their skills. They knew the river. These are men who had spent decades learning that river.
And imagining what it would be like in these flood conditions.
In their own minds, in particular Kent and Grua. I think they had every expectation of surviving, but it's important to keep in mind that because they decided to launch illegally under the cover of darkness, they had no idea what was happening down in the canyon. And that's the other thing. There were a series of terrible accidents that were occurring most of them occurring at a terrible rapid known as Crystal, where things had gone berserk. There was at Crystal Rapid, which is 98 miles downstream from the Glen Canyon Dam, there was a 30-foot high wall of water. A wall of water, you know, from 30 feet to trough to crest. These are dimensions you normally only see in the open ocean. It stretched from one side of the river to the other. It formed an almost impossible barrier. The huge motor rigs that pilot the canyon for giant commercial expeditions, several of these boats had flipped upside down. One of them had been torn to pieces. One person had died. The National Park Service was in the process of conducting what to that point was the largest and most complex helicopter evacuation in the history of Grand Canyon National Park. And by virtue of the fact that Grua and his two companions were sneaking onto the river, they didn't have the faintest idea that any of this stuff was happening. So an hour before midnight, on the night of June 25th, there's a full moon, which is a big part of their plan because they need as much light as they can get. They tow the Emerald Mile down to Lee's Ferry and shove her into the river. And they've got with them a car battery, a set of cables connecting that battery to a Q-beam, which is a powerful spotlight that is often used for hunting deer in the dark. And their idea is that with the combination of the full moon and this Q-beam, what they want to do is each man is going to row as hard as he possibly can for 20 minutes until his fingers can no longer uncurl by themselves from the oars, and he is completely exhausted, at which point he will peel back his fingers and step out of the cockpit and turn the oars over to his companion. And in this manner, these three men, rotating around the decks of this little wooden dory, will row night and day without stopping, without scouting a single rapid. They will thread this river, which all of them know intimately, but which has now turned into a beast that in many ways is unrecognizable to them because they have never experienced 93,000 cubic feet per second in the bottom of the Grand Canyon. And they will continue rowing until they reach the end, with the hope of setting the speed record.
This was not, we're coming so close to the end of the hour. This was not uncomplicated. They were ejected from the boat. The boat suffered serious damage. Because we don't have time to tell the rest of the story, can you just talk about what, knowing as a river guide, can you talk about the way that your senses are engaged to keep you alive in a situation where you have to be cognizant of everything around you and thinking ahead?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question, and it's not something that I think I could have answered before having gone through this apprenticeship that I had to undertake to really research the book. But the thing about whitewater and the thing about rowing an oar boat, in particular a wooden boat with wooden oars, is that this is a small boats. Transmit a lot of information to you, and not all of that information is visual. There are an awful lot of signals that get sent up through the hull of a boat and up the shafts, the blades and the shafts of a set of oars. And the boat at a certain point, if you've spent enough time in one, almost becomes a set of antennae for a good boatman. And I'm not a good boatman, by the way, but I've done it enough to be able to sort of appreciate this. But sensing the river, feeling how it flows, feeling where the water is going, feeling where the water wants to go, this is the kind of connection that you develop. This is the kind of connection these men had, and it's what got them through.
Kevin Fidarko's new book is called The Emerald Mile, the epic story of the fastest ride in history through the heart of the Grand Canyon. By the way, there is more adventure on the TED Radio Hour Sunday from 2 to 3 when there are several adventurers profiled. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
It's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy with Christina Martinez on the phones and Christine McConnell producing the podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I am Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.